ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Joe Clement, your host today. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. And the voice that you heard, if you've been listening for years, you know that is our Clayton Morgeridge. We are in our second week of mourning as Clayton passed last month, and we're going to be having some words later to share about him and a piece from the archives that fits in with Old Mole themes. Today's show is going to start out, though, with Bill Resnick talking with James Offsink of Portland Forward. They're going to be talking about the struggle over bringing more community insight and priorities into the Portland Police Bureau's contract with the city. We're going to hear a reading from Jamaican-American poet June Jordan. This is selected by our friend Michelle. It's a really good reading of a poem about my rights. Later in the show, as I mentioned, I'm going to share some words and memories about Clayton Morgeridge, and we're going to hear his piece about abolishing slavery as a prefigurative act of abolishing capitalism. And to wrap up today's show, Left in the Law is going to be talking with Laura Regan of the Civil Liberties Defense Center. They're going to be talking about anti-protest laws, laws that are trying to discriminate against people who speak out against the government, against the powers. They're going to be talking about developments in that front. You can listen to the show in a day or two by going to kboo.fm/oldmolevarietyhour, or just Old Mole. You can find the whole show or the individual segments to share and enjoy. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter by just looking for Old Mole Variety Hour. And you can contact us by emailing oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. We're interested in having more people get involved with the show, either as hosts, as engineers, doing interviews or commentaries. We're going to start off today's show, though, now with Bill Resnick and James Offsink.
James Offsink, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
James Offsink is the president of Portland Forward, an organization that self-describes itself, and I quote, "The magnitude of challenges we face on a global and local level require a broad and bold progressive vision and the political will and strategy to see it through." James himself has worked at Common Cause Oregon with the Portland Resistance and is now working with the big coalition, the Portland Police Reform Network, that's challenging the Portland Police in the current negotiation of the Police Association's union contract with the city. So, James Offsink, tell us about the police contract battle, why it's so important, the various provisions that are in the contract that you're challenging. Well, that's it.
Thank you for the question, Bill. There's a lot of issues with the Portland Police Association contract, and actually nationally, police contracts tend to be kind of the tip of the spear, like one of the ways that justice is really circumvented across the country. And so specifically for the Portland Police contract, like a lot of contracts nationwide, it lacks really key transparency and accountability measures that allow police to operate often not in the public interest without any kind of accountability. So the main things that we're calling for are for there to be true accountability, where officers who behave outside of the public interest can legitimately be fired for poor actions or other types of discipline taken against them. And we're looking for independent civilian oversight, especially in cases that are the most important to the public, like use of deadly force. Our current contract basically cuts the public out of the process, even though there is an independent civilian process for some police conduct. It's in our Portland Police Association contract that in cases of deadly force, it specifically excludes the Independent Police Review Board from participating. So we want to make sure that those things are out. We also want, we call for a number of other things in our demands, including that there's drug testing of officers after use of deadly force. You know, if a truck driver is in an accident, it is assured that the first thing that happens when police respond to the scene is that the truck driver takes a drug test to make sure that they were operating, you know, with full use of their faculties. We think that the same thing should be true for police officers. After use of force, we want to be sure that they're not, you know, impaired in some way, that maybe they made the wrong judgment.
Any kind of force, not just homicide, murderous force, but shootings, beatings as well.
That's
severe,
right.
Beatings,
tasings. I mean, there's a lot of things that are considered less than lethal force, which, if you look nationally, actually do kill a lot of people,
including those non-lethal weapons.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's one of the ways that I first became connected to this issue, was actually participating in peaceful protests after the election of Donald Trump, and, you know, being subject to all kinds of use of police force that were supposedly, you know, less than lethal. But certainly when you have somebody firing, you know, bullets at you, it's hard to know at the outset if they're rubber or, you know, if they will in fact kill someone or hurt someone.
In fact, James, the current practice, or at least the current practice until recently, was to give the cop who did it, you offer him a lot of coffee right away to drink, and they then secrete the police officer for 2 days before he has to submit to any tests or, in fact, tell the story. That is, he gets to see his lawyer within 2 days and doesn't have to say a word. Is that still happening?
Well, it's a little bit contested at the moment. So in the previous police contract, the one from 2016, they did change what was known as the 48-hour rule, that basically said, as part of the contract, that police could not be required to respond to any questions. And that was based on a whole bunch of debunked criminology science that was intended to favor moving away from police accountability. And that's no longer in the contract. And so in general, they are questioning police within a shorter period of time from when the thing happens.
But only police.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, that's nice.
It's good. It's positive.
It feels good to be a cop, not to be questioned by someone who might not believe and help you spin a story.
Yeah, and that's another thing actually that we're pushing for in the contract, is really that there is the appearance of two systems of justice, which we think is inherently unfair. There's one system of justice that you go through if you are a member of the public who is being questioned by police, and that includes, you know, extended interview times. It includes all kinds of things that are specifically barred in the police association contract. So, for instance, in the police association contract, they're required to have at least a 10-minute break in any questioning session with an officer who's been, you know, suspected of doing something wrong. They're also required, they limit the duration of the interview periods. And, you know, all of those things, if that is what is most likely to produce the truth, then we think that it should be true both for police officers and also for members of the public. So if police officers are required to get 10-minute breaks in every hour of interview sessions, then we think that the same should be true for civilians.
Agreed. Let's go back to the Civilian Review Board. Their disciplinary, the measures that they think would be required for whatever the action was, that's just advisory, basically, is my understanding. On the other hand, they would get subpoena power. And subpoena power, it seems to me, is a powerful, powerful thing, because you get testimony under oath, I believe, and the truth can come out if you subpoena enough people and have somebody who's questioning, you know, having the experience and capacity to really bring out the what really happened in this situation.
Yeah, definitely. Part of what we're asking for is for our Civilian Review Board, which is the independent police review board, that they would have the ability to compel officer testimony. Because right now they can just ask officers to answer their questions, but the officers are not required to provide answers. The officers are required to show up, but not to answer any of the questions that are offered. Mm. So you can imagine how that works against getting to the bottom of what the truth really is.
I'm sure they show up with their lawyers more than one on each side. They need protection. So this is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole. I'm talking to James Offsink. We've been talking about the struggle over the police contract, why it's so important, what the network is doing, the Portland Police Reform Network, as well as what we hope the community will do, which is stand up for justice. James, let's get to the negotiation. It's the city and the Portland Police Association that's negotiating. The network is not negotiating, and in fact may not be able even to observe the negotiations. That appears to be part of the whole system that the police will not give up and have power over. What are the powers then of the network? You did testify before the city council about the necessary changes, and Joanne Hardesty, who's been crucial, I think, to raising these issues, she is on the council, and she will certainly be demanding that the negotiators for her and the other council members bring up all of these issues and fight for them and don't compromise them in ways that make them, you know, without any real significance. You have another power, though, I think, as well. I mean, you have already made those demands, and Joanne is, in one way or another, championing them before the council and making those demands as well. And the council still has other people supporting it, Joanne, in that endeavor.
So we have a lot of momentum in this specific contract. And in the past, I think that how you described it is right, Bill, that there... really, the community was not engaged in the process until the very end. After the contract had been negotiated, it came to City Council. And at that point, City Council is only a up or down yes or no vote. Should we accept this contract that's been negotiated or not? That is a very difficult time for the community to come in and be able to say, point, City Council is only a up or down yes or no vote. Should we accept this contract that's been negotiated or not? That is a very difficult time for the community to come in and be able to say, you know, we like some aspects of this contract, but not other aspects. So this time, the Police Reform Network, which is a constellation of different groups, faith communities, communities of color, good government groups who have come together to say, no, we want to make sure that we can materially influence the contract as it's being negotiated so that when it comes to City Council at the end, should it come to City Council, which it doesn't have to, because police, if they reach an impasse where they can't negotiate, then it goes to an arbitrator down the line. But if it does come to City Council, we want to have it be as good as possible when it gets to council. So we've already had, through Commissioner Hardesty's office, as you mentioned, she's been a real ally on these issues, and she was a leader for a long time, even before being elected to council. And she has helped bring in national experts on police reform who can look at this nationwide and say, you know, here are the problems that we're seeing across cities and counties everywhere, and help inform what Portland should be doing. And that happened late last year, and the council was really receptive. Since then, the council has actually agreed to host two community listening sessions, which is unprecedented, at least in recent history in Portland. When a police contract came up, they invited community members to come in. There were several hundred community members across two different nights in November and December. And we're looking forward to actually the release probably this week of the results of those community listening sessions, which we expect to add to the public record just how important it is that the council adopt real accountability measures, increase civilian oversight, and have transparency through this whole process. So to, in summary, kind of answer your question, yes, it is very important for our movements to be as bold and broad as possible, and we really welcome anyone who's interested in these issues to get involved. We have an event coming up through Portland Forward, actually, on February 19th. We're hosting a conversation about what people want to see change in Portland police and policing. And we'd love to have people come to that. You can get the information about it on our Facebook page. It's going to be at the Alberta Street Pub at 6 p.m. on Wednesday, February 19th. But if, you know, people want to be involved in other ways, if they want to really bird dog and participate or track what's happening in the contract, we've just recently found out that the sessions will likely alternate between being open and being closed. So public...
The negotiating sessions.
Negotiating sessions for the contract.
And some of them will be open.
Well, it's not 100% finalized yet. We were just in we got to observe a ground rules meeting that the city and the PPA were negotiating just last Friday. And it is tentative. It looks like they'll alternate sessions between being open and being closed to the public. So we're definitely still invested in how do we get high quality information about what the city is proposing to make sure that they're tracking to the things that the community thinks is important. But it does look promising that at least some of the sessions will be open to the public, which is unlike they were in the last contract negotiation.
James, one final issue. For me, something extremely important is reducing police numbers, having half as many police or less, and replacing them with helping services for the homeless, for people with mental health crises, for people with drug use arrests. They should be replaced with workers who are much better qualified and capable of helping those people and getting them whatever they need to straighten out, which most of them, in fact, want.
That's exactly right, Bill. You've really hit the nail on the head about the importance of, in our society today, unfortunately, police are sent in to lots of issues that they have not the training nor the resources to solve. So it is very important, and I'm encouraged by the pilot program that the city has adopted, the Portland Street Response, which looks to send in unarmed, non-militarized resources into situations where somebody is experiencing a mental health crisis instead of sending in a police officer with a weapon. So I do think that that is a promising development, and our network will be looking in the future for how do we shift resources from the punitive kind of injustices of our current system into social services and other resources that really get to the root of why people are calling the police in the first place. We don't, you know, police have very limited ability to solve someone who's, you know, going through a severe addiction withdrawal, right? But we do have services in our city, and we should have more, but there are places that can help with those types of situations before they become emergencies that require a gun.
James Opstink, again, you're a great credit to this community and doing really good work, and your organization as well, and the Police Reform Network. Thanks a lot. And we'll be talking again as these negotiations go on to rally the people. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me on the show, Bill, and for continuing to track this very important issue.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was Bill Resnick and James Offsink talking about the Portland Police Bureau contract and the different stakeholders that are trying to weigh in on how that gets negotiated. Up next, we're going to hear a poem, a excerpt from a reading of a poem by June Jordan, a Jamaican-American poet and political essayist. The poem is titled A Poem About My Rights.
Poem About My Rights. Even tonight, and I need to take a walk and clear my head about this poem about why I can't go out without changing my clothes, my shoes, my body posture, my gender identity, my age, my status as a woman alone in the evening, alone on the streets, alone not being the point. The point being that I can't do what I want to do with my own body because I am the wrong sex, the wrong age, the wrong skin. And suppose it was not here in the city, but down on the beach or far into the woods, and I wanted to go there by myself, thinking about God or thinking about children or thinking about the world, all of it disclosed by the stars and the silence. I could not go, and I could not think, and I could not stay there alone as I need to be alone, because I can't do what I want to do with my own body. And who in the hell set things up like this? And if after all of my kinsmen and women resist, even to self-immolation of the villages, and if after that we lose nevertheless, what will the big boys say? Will they claim my consent? Do you follow me? We are the wrong people of the wrong skin on the wrong continent, and what in the hell is everybody being reasonable about? And according to the Times this week, the CIA decided that they had this problem, and the problem was a man named Nkrumah, so they killed him. And before that, it was Patrice Lumumba. And before that, it was my father on the campus of my Ivy League school, and my father afraid to walk into the cafeteria because, he said, he was wrong. The wrong age, the wrong skin, the wrong gender identity, and he was paying my tuition. And before that, it was my father saying I was wrong, saying that I should have been a boy because he wanted one, a boy, and that I should have been lighter skin, and that I should have had straighter hair, and that I should not be so boy crazy, but instead I should just be one, a boy. And before that, it was my mother pleading plastic surgery for my nose and braces for my teeth and telling me to let the books loose, to let them loose. In other words, I am very familiar with the problems of the CIA and the problems of South Africa and the problems of Exxon Corporation and the problems of white America in general, and the problems of the teachers and the preachers and the FBI and the social workers and my particular mom and dad. I am very familiar with the problems because the problems turn out to be me. I am the history of rape. I am the history of the rejection of who I am. I am the history of the terrorized incarceration of myself. I am the history of battery, assault, and limitless armies against whatever I want to do with my mind and my body and my soul. And whether it's about walking out at night, or whether it's about the love that I feel, or whether it's about the sanctity of my vagina, or the sanctity of my national boundaries, or the sanctity of my leaders, or the sanctity of each and every desire that I know from my personal and idiosyncratic and indisputably single and singular heart, I have been raped because I have been wrong. The wrong sex, the wrong age, the wrong skin, the wrong nose, the wrong hair, the wrong need, the wrong dream, the wrong geographic, the wrong sartorial. I have been the meaning of rape. I have been the problem everyone seeks to eliminate by forced penetration, with or without the evidence of slime. And but let this be unmistakable. This poem is not consent. I do not consent to my mother, to my father, to the teachers, to the FBI, to South Africa, to Bedford Stuy, to Park Avenue, to American Airlines, to the hard-on idlers on the corners, to the sneaky creeps in cars. I am not wrong. Wrong is not my name. My name is my own, my own, my own. And I can't tell you who the hell set things up like this, but I can tell you that from now on, my resistance, my simple and daily and nightly self-determination may very well cost you your life.
It's not my fault not where I was, not how I dress. And it's not my fault not where I was, not how I dress. And the rapist was you. Patriarchy is our judge. That imprisons us at birth is rape.
Oppressive state is a macho rapist, it's oppressive state.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was a flash mob performance in Los Angeles of the Chilean feminist anthem El Violador Es Tú. It says that the rapist is you. And before that, we heard a reading from June Jordan of her poem, A Poem About My Rights, a poem with so many important things to say, terrible, but important things to say. Up next, we're going to turn to some music that I've selected from Old Mole Clayton Morgeridge's duo career with Ernie Tong. It's a classic song that we've heard on the Old Mole before, and then after that, we're going to return to hear some memories and another piece by Clayton.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I ain't dead. Says Joe, but I ain't dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill went on to organize, went on to organize. San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers fight and organize, it's there you'll find Joe Hill. It's there you'll find Joe Hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Joe Clement, your host for today. That was Clayton Morgeridge, accompanied by Ernie Tong, singing Joe Hill by Alfred Hayes and Earl Robinson. It's one of a number of tunes made or otherwise sung famously by Paul Robeson that Clayton liked to sing. I first met Clayton 12, 13 years ago when I posted a want ad on Craigslist for participants in a continental philosophy reading group that I wanted to start. I wanted to get outside of the academic circles that I had been in. Clayton was one of the 15 or 20 people who had responded to that and showed up for the first meeting, and after several more meetings, I wasn't able to continue the group, and we lost touch. Fast forward to the summer of 2009, and Facebook tells me that there's this person that I may know. It was Clayton. I can't exactly remember the timing of it, but I reached out to him and reconnected and found out that he had kept a small group of the original participants of the reading group I started. And because I was working a job where I could sit and listen to the radio, I decided to check out the show that Clayton told me he was involved with on KABU 90.7 FM. I'd never really listened to KABU before, you know? I had thought that it was something like the cable access TV equivalent of the radio, and had been listening to NPR for years, thinking that that was progressive. And then I started listening to The Old Mole and KABU because of Clayton, and I was hooked. By January of 2010, I had been starting to come to the Mole's monthly planning meetings. I'd gone to volunteer orientation, shadowing under the then regular engineers for the Old Mole. Clayton also took me under his wing to teach me how he posted the show, cutting up the individual segments, making them their own thing, putting in all the links and the pictures. For a while, I lived down the street from Clayton in Selwood. And to my surprise, one of my building mates was a student of Clayton's and had traveled abroad with him. Clayton lived a long life and touched many people. He sung, he wrote, he traveled, he thought. He contributed to the Old Mole Variety Hour for most of the last 30 years. And with that, I'd like to turn to a piece from almost 5 years ago that he wrote. It is a commentary and a bit of a reading about how the American Civil War was a war over property relations. A war that's never really ended, but has gone underground and continues to this day in our political and economic institutions.
Well, the guiding star of political action, from the Old Mole's point of view, is the democratic control and ownership of the wealth and resources required to produce our lives. That is, everything that falls under the heading of capital. Pretty much all of this capital is now, directly or indirectly, under the control of the wealthiest tenth of the top 1% of the population, or in the U.S., about 320,000 people. It is their interest in maintaining and expanding their power that dictates what the rest of us have to do, how we have to work in order to live. Genuinely radical political action always aims at chipping away at and eventually abolishing the power of the capitalist class and the basis of that power, the private ownership of capital. The goal is a world in which we all together decide how we shall live. This is what revolution is, fundamental change in the relations of property, and therefore of the conditions of labor. Now, to appreciate what it takes to make such a revolution, it is worth looking back at what has been called the Second American Revolution, the Civil War, and the abolition of slavery. With the end of the war and the passage of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, the right to own human beings as property was abolished. The result was that what had been property, almost 4 million enslaved people, valued at over $3 billion, or 18% of the total of all U.S. wealth, suddenly ceased to be property, and all that wealth vanished from the economy. This was a revolution more radical than the first one of 1776 because it worked a fundamental change in property relations. Let's look back at the debate over slavery and the principle of private property in the decades leading up to the Civil War. The Fifth Amendment to the Constitution declares that no one can be deprived of their property without due process of law. Now, did that mean that the nation could not deprive enslavers of their property in human beings? Did it mean government could not prohibit moving slaves into new territories? The main issue in the 1830s and 40s was whether the government had the right to stop the expansion of slavery into new territories by admitting new states to the Union as free states. Those who profited from slavery, not only those who owned and drove enslaved people in the South, but the many northern investors in slaves and cotton, knew that slavery could only thrive if it kept expanding to keep up with the world market in cotton. Abolitionists and others who opposed slavery also understood this and hoped to end it by confining it to where it already existed, and by repealing the laws that required Northern officials to return escaped slaves to their enslavers. In 1836, abolitionists were calling for Congress to use its power over federal territory to end the slave trade and even to ban slavery itself in the District of Columbia. Here is how the South responded, as described by historian Edward Baptist in his book, The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. South Carolina Senator John C. Calhoun responded to these anti-slavery demands with a speech that outlined a foundational idea. He told the Senate that the Fifth Amendment limited federal power over individuals' property by decreeing that no one could be deprived of his property without due process of law. Calhoun now proceeded to build a sweeping principle on the back of this sentence. Due process, he insisted, could mean only trial by jury of a specific criminal. What the abolitionists proposed was the opposite of due process, legislative fiat that erased the property claims of a whole class of people. And, said Calhoun, were not the slaves of this district property, and were not their enslavers a whole class of property owners? Presumably, Congress could not prevent people from buying or selling said property, since salability is usually one of property's characteristics. Baptist goes on, Calhoun was stating an idea that would eventually be known as the doctrine of substantive due process. The due process requirements to which the Constitution referred could not be fulfilled simply by passing a law, for a law that invaded the rights of property owners ran up against something too fundamental for procedure to alter. In Calhoun's vision, the Fifth Amendment was a geological outcropping that confirmed that beneath the Constitution lay an underlying substantive tectonic plate of natural law that allowed owners to hold and use property. Now, in 1847, Calhoun went on to argue that the Fifth Amendment denied Congress any right to require that new states outlaw slavery, complaining, quote, resolved, that the enactment of any law which should directly or by its effects deprive the citizens of any of the states of this Union from emigrating with their property into any of the territories of the United States would unjustly discriminate between citizens of slave states and citizens of free states, and would therefore be a violation of the Constitution. He implied that the federal government should actually pass laws to enact the institution of slavery on federal territory, for to do otherwise would be to deprive individual slave owners and indeed all Southern whites, who were, after all, potential property owners, of their rights to emigrate with their property. End of quote. Well, it took a civil war and a constitutional amendment to remove human beings from the category of private property and free them from the direct ownership of capital. But capital still owns and controls the wealth enslaved people created, and it continues to expropriate that so-called free labor today and to dictate the conditions of labor and life. To protect the rights of capital, the principle of substantive due process protecting private property that was laid down by Calhoun is very much with us today. As Edward Baptiste writes, after the Civil War, pro-big business legal thinkers from the North would, ironically enough, take up a version of Calhoun's idea. From the 1890s through the New Deal era, the Supreme Court repeatedly used substantive due process to strike down legislative attempts to regulate Gilded Age industry, protect workers' rights, or break up monopolies. Substantive due process shaped and continues to shape the political economy of the United States in enduring ways. End of quote. A good case can be made that reparations should be paid to the descendants of slaves for the wealth that was beaten and sweated out of them. But the wealth owned and controlled by the very wealthiest families rules our world to the extent that a recent study of political power concluded that the U.S. is a plutocracy. expropriating that wealth and putting it in public hands. That is the next revolution. Abolishing the private ownership of human beings was not easy. Neither will be the abolition of private property in the wealth our labor creates. I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was Clayton Morgridge with a commentary about slavery and capitalism and the abolition of property relations. You can find that and many more of his commentaries and readings on the Old Mole website, the KBOO website, by just going to kboo.fm and searching for Clayton Morgridge. We tag all his work with his name. Well, to wrap up today's show, we're going to have another installment of The Left and the Law. And in this segment, Jan Hocken talks with Lauren Regan, Executive Director and Senior Staff Attorney with the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene. Regan is lead criminal defense attorney in recent and several upcoming trials of climate activists. They'll talk about the history of fossil fuel industry lobbying in shaping anti-protest laws and charges against activists as eco-terrorists. Jan?
Welcome to KBOO, Lauren Regan.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you bring decades of experience as a movement lawyer to our topic today, the legal terrain of the climate movement. And as founder and staff attorney at the Civil Liberties Defense Center, you have defended thousands of activists from around the country, as well as here in the Pacific Northwest. And we'll be talking later about a few of the upcoming trials of climate activists, including one this month in Portland, where you're lead defense attorney. But let's start with anti-protest laws and changes you have seen over time and confronted in the courts around criminalizing protests. Can you speak to some of the highlights and lowlights of that history?
Sure. I mean, I think the first thing that I would say is over 20 years of a career and developing a really strong network of mentors with even more years than that, one of the things that you learn is, you know, if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. And the thing with repression, state repression, which in my mind, you know, includes things like laws that target dissent, target activism, grand juries, police brutality, or like overblown showing of force by law enforcement. All of those things are different forms of repression by the state, and that is nothing new. There are just a perpetual wave of different forms of repression, you know, painted with different colors, but the overall goal of that kind of repression is always the same, which generally speaking is to keep those in power, and to continue to, you know, either maintain or increase profits for some of them at the expense of activists that are fighting to change those dynamics and those structures. So, you know, every few years there is a new wave of anti-protest laws that target one particular movement or subset of the movement, and people tend to like freak out thinking, you know, the end is near and, you know, fascism is upon us. And then another wave, you know, that kind of ebbs and flows, and then another wave begins. So, you know, I think the one thing that activists need to remember is, you know, we're picking sides, and that's been going on for a long time. And you should expect that when you are targeting the profits of a multinational corporation, or you're targeting the government or law enforcement, you should expect a pitched battle in that. And when the state plays dirty, or when the state uses its power to try and pass laws to scare people away from being part of your movement, that shouldn't be surprising. We should be prepared for that. We should be able to undercut that or dismantle it in a way that leaves the state confused.
And that's been an issue in the water protectors and land protectors fight against Line 3 in Minnesota. You've been involved as lead defense attorney in the Valve Turners trial there and cases in four states. But many of the activists in Minnesota have talked about the militarizing of the police and anticipation of further resistance there to Line 3, bringing tar sands oil into that region, and the way in which Enbridge and other fossil fuel companies support or fortify the police response. Can you speak at all to that?
Sure. You know, I mean, I think that when fights like Line 3 take place, it only reinforces the importance of mass movements because, you know, particularly in rural areas, when we look to Germany and how activists there battled the coal mines, you know, thousands of people swarmed into coal mines and basically sat down and shut down the mines. And I think that, you know, we can't underestimate that the state would like to divide and conquer, you know, any kind of dissent or any kind of activism against it. When you talk about the critical energy infrastructure laws, you know, like those that were used against the valve turners in Minnesota, you know, those are not really effective tools of the state because, especially in the case of the valve turners, they were going, you know, they were prepared to break the law. They were prepared to take the consequences of breaking the law, regardless of what that law was. So whether it was trespassing or burglary or critical energy infrastructure law, the name attached to that law was not going to determine whether or not those activists took the action that they did. And so when the fossil fuel industry, you know, in collusion with elected leaders that are bought and paid for by that industry, when they get together and do the industry's bidding and attempt to further criminalize activism by passing those kinds of laws, what they are really saying is, we're afraid of you, climate movement. You're being successful. We're on our heels. And so we're pulling out all of our, you know, last ditch efforts that we can purchase in order to try and basically defend our profits, you know, defend our right to exist. But it's not really an effective tactic. I think the other reason where when you see the industries, you know, whether it's pharmaceutical and, you know, massive ag passing the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, or whether it's fossil fuel industry passing these critical energy infrastructure laws, the other thing that's going on there is they are using their money to try and frame the narrative for the public. You know, they are purchasing legislation because there are a lot of people who still believe that if the state passes a law and makes something a crime, it must be bad. And so, you know, by passing laws, the industry is hoping that at least some segment of the population is going to think, oh, climate activists wrong, targeting the fossil fuel industry and these pipelines that are actually, you know, destroying your water source and impacting your children's health and exacerbating climate change. You know, normally things that we, the people, would think are direct threats to us, by having the industry purchase a law that says that targeting that infrastructure is wrong, there are still people that will believe that. You know, I think more and more that is coming into question.
Can you talk? Sorry. Yeah, and one site and stage for calling that into question on moral grounds, the fossil fuel industry and the infrastructure, are these trials where they attract a lot of interest. There's a lot at stake. Here, there will be ongoing coverage of the trial of activists who are facing criminal charges, trespassing that result from an April 2019 action intended to disrupt Zenith Energy Management's role in the global production movement and burning of fossil fuels from tar sands in Canada. Can you give us a preview of that upcoming trial? You'll be serving as lead defense attorney. What's at stake there, and what's important about this kind of trial?
Well, as one of the attorneys defending the activists involved in that, you know, my advocacy is somewhat limited because the trial is coming up in a couple of weeks. But I would say that the significance of it is that, similar to the Valve Turner cases that we've done around the country, we intend to be able to utilize the climate necessity defense with a Multnomah County jury. And in that case, you know, what is interesting is the city of Portland took certain steps to pass policy that was trying to be responsive to the imminent climate crisis that we face. And they basically passed, you know, put things on paper saying, no more fossil fuel infrastructure. We know that actually we have to go the other way, you know, around, and we need to be reducing that, not creating infrastructure to increase it. But despite that, Zenith Energy began expanding its facility and building more of that infrastructure specifically for tar sands. Despite the city's statement to the contrary, and it was taken up to the Land Use Board of Appeals and to the Court of Appeals, where legal fights continue to be fought about whether or not local governments are allowed to take the health of their community into account and put down clear lines saying no more. You know, you've got the existing stuff that you've got, but no new infrastructure that will exacerbate climate change. And then, of course, you have the industry as a whole fighting against that and basically saying, how dare you tell us that we can't make billions of dollars of profits harming the health of your local community? We're going to like force this through regardless of what you say.
So one of the key elements of the necessity defense is the demand on defendants to explain how they have tried other alternatives, and that breaking the moral arguments for breaking the law or the lesser of two evils outweighs the harms alleged by their acts. Is that a higher bar in a state or area like Portland that has been seen as a model in passing anti-fossil fuel laws or law?
I mean, the choice of evils is a state statute, and you know, we've been attempting to use it for activists for, you know, the 20 years that I've been a lawyer. So that is nothing new. I think that currently the district attorney's position is that, you know, they are agreeing with us that a defendant has a Sixth Amendment right to put on a full defense, and they are not trying to block us like Washington and Minnesota, you know, many of the Valve Turner cases where the state, you know, initially attempted to exclude that kind of testimony. So, you know, that's based on state law. That's not specific to Portland. You know, this type of defense can be used anywhere in the state of Oregon. And you are right, you know, one of the tests that the defendants have to establish is that, you know, there was an imminent serious harm that they were seeking to mitigate or combat, and that they tried all reasonable legal alternatives before, you know, deciding to break the law. And so when you look at electoral politics, litigation, outreach and education, legislative and administrative rulemaking, you know, when you look at all those reasonable legal alternatives, what you recognize and what our experts will testify is that those traditional democratic systems of democracy are broken and corrupted right now, and they are not working.
Well, thank you so much, Lauren Regan, for being with us today and giving us that history as well as what we face going forward. And we will be continuing to follow the trial of Extinction Rebellion activists that were that will face charges, and as well as an excellent defense team here in the Multnomah County Courthouse on February 24th, as well as a case in Mount Vernon in Washington coming up in April as well. Thank you so much for being with us today, Lauren Regan, and I assume we can find out more about the Civil Liberties Defense Center on your website, including cases that you're following and the history of cases. Is that the best place to find to track you?
Yeah, cldc.org is our website, and we will definitely be putting up updates, including Ken Ward's new trial date once that is set by the court tomorrow. So, and thanks for having me, Jan.
Thanks so much. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. I've been your host, Joe Clement. I want to say special thanks to our guests, to Jan and Lauren Regan, for talking about anti-protest laws and the case histories that are building around basically criminalizing our fighting back against this murderous system we live in. Thanks to Bill Resnick and James Offsink for talking about another arm of the murderous system we live in, the Portland Police Bureau and their contract, and what the community is trying to do to have some oversight over what police can and cannot get away with. Thanks to Fran Michelle for finding that amazing reading by June Jordan of her poem, A Poem About My Rights, and the flash mob from L.A. singing The Rapist Is You. And thank you to Clayton Morgridge, who we will be remembering for the weeks to come, for many years of sharing your mind and heart with the KBOO listener community. You can listen to the Old Mole Variety Hour at kboo.fm/oldmole. Listen to the whole show and past segments. Tune in next week, Monday, 9 to 10 a.m.